Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, have we reached peak interest rates? The Bank of England holds steady again, but why? What next? And what does it all mean for your money? Also today, the best way to keep your house warm this winter. How do we solve a problem like the triple lock? And from Taylor Swift tickets to Uggs, hot scam trends to look out for in 2024. Plus, Lee wants something from you. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, the Bank of England opted once again to hold the base rate at 5.25% this week, a move which will reinforce the view that we've reached the peak. At one time, it was thought that rates would hit the heady heights of 6.5%. There are other economic indicators which suggest that markets think the only way is down from here. But it was by no means a unanimous decision. So where will they head next? And what does it mean for mortgages, savings and the wider economy? Welcome, Lee. Welcome, Simon. Simon, another hold. Why?
Because if they'd have raised interest rates or cut them, that would have really put the cat amongst the pigeons, wouldn't it? We're at the position now where pretty much everybody has decided that rates have peaked. Apart from three members of the Monetary Policy Committee who decided that they should go up, exactly. Which was actually quite surprising. It was dubbed a hawkish hold because the hawks wanted to raise rates. And it was so surprising that our very own news editor, Mike Sheen, actually initially read the Bank of England minutes as three of them had voted for a cut and then went, whoa, hold on a minute. I've just read it's actually a hold and I just read what I thought I read. So that was quite a surprise. The Fed had voted to hold rates the night before, which is quite important. It's the Fed that sets the tone for monetary policy around the world. But the Bank of England's looking at the UK economy, which is quite a different place to the American economy. It's looking at the inflation that we've got. It's looking at how they're concerned inflation might get entrenched. There was a big drop, though, in the last inflation numbers. The economy does seem to be cooling. The British consumer does appear to be being slightly dented by all of these rate rises. Eventually, it's obviously put massive dampeners on the housing market, massively slowed construction. We've got GDP fell 0.3% in the last reading over 1 month. Monthly figures are very erratic on GDP. But all of the signs point to the tough medicine that the Bank of England has been delivering over 2 years now. They first went up in December 2021. Those 14 rate rises in a row, all of the evidence points to the fact that tough medicine is starting to work and they probably don't need to be raising rates again. But what they want to do is keep that in our minds that they might raise rates again so that we don't think that it's okay, we don't need to worry, and then we cause more inflation ourselves. They don't want us asking for those pay rises. They don't want companies putting up the price of their goods. They don't want all of those things that will create inflation in the future. But obviously, none of them think that we should be cutting rates yet. And Andrew Bailey has been keen to stress that he thinks markets, commentators, economists, all of us who spend endless amounts of time speculating on interest rates are running well ahead of ourselves in thoughts that rates are going to get aggressively cut next year.
Well, what is going to happen? What is the speculation next year? Because I was reading your article, it's someone saying that higher for longer is going to stick, although we might get down to 4% by the end of the year.
Well, I mean, those two things they don't really fit together, do they? You know, what the Bank of England is trying to tell people, the message that it's trying to put out there, and then there's the message that markets are taking from things that are happening. What you have to remember, though, is that markets are regularly completely wrong on all of this. It was only over the summer during the inflation panic that sent mortgage rates spiraling and savings rates soaring, the markets were pricing in 6.5% by the end of the year. Rates were going to peak at 6 to 6.5%. We've not got anywhere near that. So they weren't, you know, they were quite wrong not so long ago, if rates stop here, you know. And you've also got the scenario in America where one of the analysts was talking about 1.75% being cut off the Fed funds rate next year, 175 basis points. Can't see that one happening. I mean, my personal view is that central banks are going to look at what's happened as a bit of a lucky accident to be where they are now. They've got away with raising rates so much off the floor, and they want rates to stick around normal. They don't want to go up and then straight back down and go back to those emergency interest rates, because they're causing all kinds of problems in the financial system, in economies. You know, they totally warp everything from stock market to the housing market to economic behavior. So they don't want to go straight back down. They'd like to settle at a higher level. The question is, what is that higher level? And I had a conversation with the COO of a major bank the other week that will remain unnamed. And he said, you know, well, we think normal is probably about 4%. So that's probably where you look at the central banks and think they might end up back at maybe 4-4.5%.
Lee, what does it mean for our money? Let's take a look at mortgages. So what next for fixed deals? What's going on?
Yeah, so when we had all of the mortgage panic over the summer again, when markets were talking about 6-6.5% base rate by the end of the year, it sent mortgage rates into a bit of a kind of upward trajectory again, which, you know, rates aren't completely aligned to what base rate does, but on the whole, when they rise, mortgage rates go up and vice versa. Now, in terms of fixes, what we've actually seen in the last, especially the last couple of weeks, major lenders are getting into a bit of a price war just ahead of the new year. They're looking for business, essentially. The property market has had a bit of a slowdown. And as a result of rates looking like they're not going to go as high as they once were, we started to see quite a lot of repricing, to the point where one mortgage broker has said today that they could see a scenario in which the very best rates could fall with below 4% early next year. I mean, I think that's a bit of a stab in the dark as to what things are doing at the moment. But the very best rate at the moment, this is depending on your LTV and all that kind of stuff, but the very best rate, if you qualify for it, is 4.29% from Nationwide. That's quite a big drop from where we were at just a few months ago. So it looks like a lot of the mortgage misery might be behind us, hopefully is behind us, but there's still a large chunk of people, for example, that are on SVRs or have chosen to go onto an SVR to try and ride this all out and hope that fixes fall back to anywhere like they were before, which looks very unlikely. But an SVR, typically between 8-9%. I mean, it's a very high rate. And if we're talking about fixed rate mortgages, 2-year fixes, 5-year fixes, becoming priced at between 4-4.5%. That, again, we're talking the very best rates here. Typically, when you look at it as an average across all LTVs, you're talking more like 6%. But for the very best rates, you know, there is that argument to be saying now, if you are on an SVR, should you be mindful and thinking about fixing again as these rates improve? So on that side of things, it looks like we are kind of over that big hump. There's like two humps, wasn't there? There was the big, really fast rise after the Kwasi Kwarteng Liz Truss mini budget. Then it all sort of simmered down a little bit. And then there's a massive spike again in the summer when there was a shock inflation report. And again, it just sent everything into a frenzy. So it's all very delicate. You know, if things can change on a penny, and that is the nuts and bolts of it, really.
One area that has been giving us cause for cheer, has it not, Lee Boyce, of late, savings. Is that it, though? Is the only way down from here?
Well, it looks that way. I mean, if you think about how fast savings rates have risen in the last 18 months, it was always going to cool off at some point. And that point seems to have peaked at the NS&I 6.2% one-year fix that was hugely popular. It was on sale for 4 or 5 weeks. Lots of people opened that up. Billions poured into it. And we kind of had that hunch that that might be the top of the market for fixes at that time. And that has proven to be the case, because now the best buy one-year fix is 5.7%. So we've chopped a whole 0.5 percentage points off the very, very best one-year fix. So I would say that it's very unlikely we're going to get back past 6% again for a one-year fix. But if you look at the data, the Bank of England data from the last year to year and a half, lots of people have been filling their boots with fixes. So I like to think that if you wanted one, you probably have got yourself a good fixed rate But it's not too late. You know, 5.7% is still not a bad rate. But the one thing I would say, easy access rates have really caught up with fixed rate savings deals. So now the best buy easy access is 5.2%. So we're only talking, again, another 0.5 percentage points between the difference between the two. So as a saver, you say to yourself, is it worth locking my money away? Can't access it for what is quite a small boost on a £10,000 pot. You're talking about the difference between about £50 of interest from going from the best 1 year fix to going for the best easy access. So a lot of people will be weighing that up, as well as doing things such as maxing out their ISAs. Now ISA rates are still lagging behind traditional rates; they always do. But it could be worth heading your money into that direction because of the personal savings allowance. So there's lots to consider. There's still rates that are far better. The one little trinket of good news I would say is that for the first time in quite a while, savings rates, the very best savings rates, are beating inflation. And rowing us all back to the base rate decision, I think about how inflation has kind of where the rate has been the last couple of years. So the last reading for inflation was 4.6%. So you could argue that base rate hikes have been doing the job. And then you look back at October 2022, and it was at 11.1%. Now, the last time it was below 4.6%, the current reading for CPI, was in October 2021. And at that time, base rate was 0.1%. So I don't know, there's all little trinkets and things that are kind of, you know, indications that things could soften next year in terms of base rate. Markets are pricing in a slightly bigger cut than they were before, and talking about cuts from potentially May, June time. But as Simon pointed out, Bank of England are kind of treading a bit more cautiously there, and always feels like a bit of a telling off to some of the commentators and market speculators.
Rein it back in. So we'll continue to speculate, which is what we do. Simon, I do want to sort of expand it out a little bit. I think you've always said, actually, going back to where we were was not the ideal situation anyway. So it's not like we are hankering after the times when interest rates were really rock bottom. So where is a good place to be?
No, what we're doing is we're getting back to the old normal, not the new normal. The new normal was the one that we've been told we needed to get used to, which was that rates were going to stay low forever, and it was a scenario where interest rates were below inflation. But that's also been marked by very low wage growth. What we want to do is get back to the old normal, where you've got wage growth, interest rates, inflation, in that order. Your wages are going up, hopefully a little bit higher than interest rates, although not necessarily that thing. What you want really is interest rates above inflation, so you're getting a real return on your money, and you want wages above inflation, so you're getting a real pay rise. And if we can get back to that scenario, we'll be in a much better position than the one that we have spent most of the last 15 years in. So where do rates need to be to deliver that? Now, that's the multi-trillion dollar question that central bankers are wrestling with right now. As I said earlier, they don't want to go straight up, straight back down. They want to go up, maybe come down a bit, and then settle a plateau. And I think that maybe, as I said a few minutes ago, we're talking the kind of 4%-ish maybe for interest rates to get us there. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, the problem with monetary policy is you're kind of tinkering a bit. What you're doing is you are adjusting the price of money so that you either increase or decrease demand to borrow that money. And when people borrow that money, it creates money that goes into the economy and it plumps up the economy. So, but you don't know exactly how that's going to work out. It tends to be there's quite a lag on the effects of it. There's even more of a lag on the effects of it nowadays than there was. We were talking not so long ago about, is monetary policy slightly broken because of people's fixed rate mortgages? But you've also got to look at business lending. And that's the thing that always gets overlooked when we're talking about interest rates, is businesses. Businesses borrow money too. And businesses don't just borrow money to go buy a bigger house or to, you know, get a new car. They borrow money to invest in their business. They borrow money to expand their business. I mean, some of them borrow money to stay afloat, but what you want is the kind of borrowing money to then put that money to productive use, because businesses work out that if they can borrow money at 4.5%, they can put that money into their business, invest it into their business activities, and they're going to get, you know, a 10% return on what they're doing there. So basically, it works out for them to borrow the money and put it to productive use. And so you do want businesses to be actively encouraged to do this. And what we've seen with rates going up so quickly is we've seen businesses get absolutely hammered. There's also, it goes through to larger businesses that issue bonds, for example. And, like, you know, bond rates are very, very important. Bond yields are very important for the government. The government doesn't want to be having to pay out, you know, 5-6% on bonds in order to get investors to buy them, for the government to borrow money and do productive things. Brackets, some people may think that many of those things are not productive, but, you know, that's an argument for another podcast. So the government wants its borrowing costs to be a bit lower, but it probably, well, I mean, the government probably wants them to be on the floor, but they also know that on the floor is not good. And as I said, I had a conversation with the COO of a major bank, you know, bank will go unnamed. And I said, yeah, we, you know, back to this old normal. And he said, yeah, absolutely, 100% agree. That's what we want to see. He's like, the question is, what is the normal? The exact question you just asked me. And I was like, well, I don't know better than I do. And he said, thinking mortgage rates around the kind of 3.5-4% mark, that would be where they'd quite like to settle.
Fair. But the Bank of England don't have like a target like they do with inflation. There's no kind of...
No. Well, the inflation is the target, so they adjust rates to try and do that. There have been questions asked in the past about maybe we should change the inflation target, because there are times when inflation will be running higher than there are other times. So, for example, the inflation target was arguably too high in the early 2000s when we were importing deflationary aspects from China, pumping out goods that was flogging to the world at cheaper and cheaper prices, this massive glut of money that was sloshing around the place, searching for somewhere to go. And then arguably the inflation target has been too low through the inflation spike that we've just seen that was triggered, you know, largely by external circumstances. But the problem is once you start tinkering with the inflation target, then you start opening the door to moving it around to try and suit yourselves, you know, and that's the whole reason why the Bank of England is independent from the government, is because if the government's setting interest rates, they might start moving them around to suit themselves. So you're opening a bit of a can of worms there.
Indeed you are. Right, Lee, while there may be better news, I guess, for our money in some quarters, not so good in others, but one area still eating away at our finances is, of course, energy. We're facing big bills again this Christmas, despite the energy price cap being lowered in October. Now, this is because there's no more universal government support package. And then we have the expectation that the cap will go up again in January. But with all of that in mind, This Is Money have been revisiting how to keep your energy usage and bills low while keeping warm this Christmas, including the battle between electric heaters versus central heating. Tip warmers, anyone? So regular listeners, of course, will remember our alternative energy warming episodes. Simon, I think it was you and Helen and I talking about that. Couldn't remember when it was. It didn't feel like a year ago. I think maybe when it was cold in March or something. Was it really a year ago? Anyway, but forget the wearable sleeping bag and Nordic quilted thermal vest. Here we look at the conventional methods. So electric heaters, central heating, electric blanket, and the good old-fashioned hot water bottle. Lee Boyce, as you were not part of the original conversation about tit warmers, otherwise known as Nordic quilted thermal vests, I go to you here to add something, some gravitas to this conversation.
I don't think I can add any more gravitas to that. I mean, where on earth do I go from that? I mean,
sorry, mate.
You've completely oversold it now. I don't even know how to respond. I mean, I want to know what these things are.
I've left you with a hot water bottle. That's what I've done.
Hot water bottle.
Oh, no. I'm taking the hot water bottles in a minute and I'll explain.
Oh, why. No. Lee, right. you've got your central heating.
Yeah. Oh wow. I mean, I can't wait. What a story. Look, as you say, energy bills are going to probably be higher for most people this year because of the reduction of government support. Now, when you think about how we use electricity and heat our homes, actually, the big thing to point out here is that gas is far cheaper per kilowatt than electricity by quite some distance, actually. So the current price cap limits gas to 6.89 pence per kilowatt hour. And for electricity, it's 27.35p. So think about that. That's quite a big difference, right? Now, a lot of homes in this country, I would argue that the vast majority of homes use gas boilers to heat their homes. And actually, of course, we've had in recent years a kind of almost like demonization of gas boilers, and that everyone should get heat pumps and then we shouldn't all get heat pumps. And I don't even know where we're at with that conversation. But for the most of us, we run the boiler, and that's how we heat our home. So we've crunched some figures here. For a 24 kW gas boiler heating a home, it costs £1.65 to run for an hour. And that's based on powering 8 radiators. For an electric version, which is we've got here is a 12 kilowatt electric boiler, it would cost £3.28 per hour. So it's quite a big difference between a gas boiler and an electric boiler. Now, I don't know how many people have electric boilers, to be quite frank with you. I wouldn't say it's probably that high. But it all depends about how you use your boiler to heat the home. There's quite a lot of variables. Where do you set your thermostat to? How many hours do you have it on? How energy efficient is your home? They're all the kind of conversations that you should really be thinking about. So I think then you kind of start comparing that to an electric heater. Now, electric heaters are good if you're heating just one room, right? So a gas boiler really is for the whole house, unless you have the special valves that go onto your radiators that control the temperature and you can switch them off. Now, I had this done in our house a couple of years ago. Right? I had all of the radiators flushed out, all cleaned. I cleaned all the backs of them. I made sure they were in tip-top condition. And then we had the valves replaced. We had old-fashioned valves that had no numbers on, had no idea what they did. And we got these fancy new ones with numbers on. But you're smiling away, Georgie, but it has made a massive difference to our energy bill, because upstairs naturally in this house is far warmer than it is downstairs. The lounge is the coolest room of the house, but it's the room we probably spend the most amount of time in, right? So we have that cranked up to the high setting. Upstairs, I have my five-year-old's room, our bedroom, and this office that I'm sitting in here at kind of half volume, and then I have one in the bathroom that's on sort of like the lowest setting. So I've gone around the house and I've kind of, it's taken a little bit of trial and error, but I know exactly what should be, you know, heated right, where and when, right? So they're the kind of things that I think are quite important to remember when you're thinking then about electric heater. I've already told you that electricity is far more expensive than gas, so naturally running an electric heater isn't cheap, right? So the cost per hour to run an electric heater is £4.37. So it's even more expensive than the electric boiler that I was talking about earlier. But if you're just using that to heat one room and it works, it could work for you instead of having the boiler running for, say, 4, 5, 6 hours. It just all depends about how you move about your home and what you do with it. So it's a little bit hard to compare. It's like going around comparing absolutely everyone's home. But those valves on those heaters are crucial. The other crucial thing that I do in this home, and I'm sure lots of other people do as well, is the draft exclusion. So this year, I invested in some better insulation tape for some of the windows. We've got a conservatory that leaks heat at the back of the house. I've any kind of little gap around windows that our porch show where we enter the house. We then have another door that comes into the lounge. Someone once had carpet in the downstairs and they've replaced it with wooden floors. What that's meant is someone has shaved the bottom of our door that links from the front door to the lounge, because we had carpet. So you would have had it. But of course, now there's a big gap where we've got wooden floors. So we have to make sure that that's all sealed off, because that all just leaks heat. So all of these things. But do you know what my number one tip is, Georgie? And this sounds so basic, and I think that people really do overlook this. It's just being dressed appropriately. Look at me.
Wear a cardi. I was going to say, I'm going to say that.
Me, right? T-shirt.
Yeah, you got chile.
I'm a big fan of the quarter zip.
Simon's in a T-shirt.
The quarter zip is in at the moment, right? Quarter zip. Now, I'm a little bit cold. I don't have the central heating on in here today because I refuse to have it on in the day. Body warmer on. Look at me. Did you hear the zip? I mean, this was body warmer. It cost me £30. And it's just, it's absolutely brilliant. The other good little device that I've heard lots of good things about. I don't have one myself. We have so many blankets in this house. I don't know if other people live like this, but my wife is obsessed with buying blankets. They're just everywhere. We've got so many blankets. I honestly think we have 15 blankets of varying kind of materials, right? And we sit on the sofa at night. She's always wrapped up in at least one blanket, possibly 15 blankets. I am just usually dressed like this because I've perfect temperature control. I'm dressed appropriately, right? You know, there's never bad weather. There's just bad dressing, right? That's my view. Yeah. So electric blankets have become all the rage in recent years. Now, the reason for that is actually they're quite inexpensive. You can usually get one for about 30, 40 quid. And an electric blanket's power rating is 0.1 kilowatt per hour. So it costs two or three pence an hour to run one of these blankets. Now, if you kind of someone that gets into bed and you're all cold, you know, you've already put that on for half an hour, you can slip in and you'll be all toasty, and it's been quite inexpensive. Now, I genuinely have heard really, really good things about electric blankets. So if you're a listener and you use one, please let me know. Although, saying that, I really don't need any more blankets in this house.
No, not by the sounds of it. Although, an electric blanket, I mean, can you convert a normal blanket? I wouldn't want to try that one. Simon, in your T-shirt there, you're either a Newcastle United fan or your heating's too high, according to Lee.
I mean, it's probably the latter. It's probably the latter, to be honest. We've just effectively done a self-build project and built a new house, and we're in there, and it's actually very well insulated, and I'm upstairs at the moment. And I had to turn the heating on earlier, and I obviously must have turned it on too much. I'm still trying to get the hang of this. So I've made it too warm, so I had to actually take my jumper off whilst we were recording this. And I think Lee's point there about thermostatic radiator valves and getting the hang of them, but also actually using them, is a really good one, because loads of people have thermostatic valves fitted that they just don't even use. They just have it set up to a high setting, or they go and they turn it up high and then they turn it down low. They use it as almost like a temperature dial for the room that they're in, which isn't the way they're meant to work. The way they're meant to work is they help get the room to a certain temperature and then they shut off. And so it means that you can have different rooms at different temperatures. The other problem people have is they have really old thermostatic valves that just don't work anymore. So it's like when your smart meter stops being connected to the internet and doesn't work, and it just becomes a dumb meter. They've got these clever radiator valves and they just go back to not being so clever. And as Lee said, the point that you need to remember is, what are you trying to do? Often we're trying to heat our home, but with lots of people doing more working from home nowadays, you can find a scenario where people are just sat in one room of the house. And if you're sat in one room of the house all day long, for example, last year in our house before we pretty much knocked it down and then built a new one, it was terribly energy efficient. And so it would warm up pretty quickly, and then the heat would just go whoosh, straight out the walls. My wife runs her own business, works from home, and she'd be sat here freezing. So I said to her, it would actually be better to use this electric heater that we've got to heat the room that she was in, rather than turning on the heating for the whole house. And I said, do please use that electric heater, because I hate the thought of you sitting here shivering all day. Because last year we were all absolutely obsessed with trying to save energy, weren't we? Ironically, as you pointed out earlier, many people's energy bills might be slightly higher this year, so we should be just as obsessed this year. But the other thing that's really important to remember when you're comparing these costs is that your boiler doesn't run all the time. You know, unless you have got your thermostat turned up to 30 degrees, unless you're trying to do 30 degrees with all the windows open, your boiler will not be running all the time. Your boiler runs, the house gets up to temperature, the thermostat reads it's up to temperature, depending on how clever your thermostat is how clever this process will work, and then the boiler switches off. So it cycles on and off. So for example, if your thermostat is set to 19 degrees, the boiler should run to try to keep the house at that temperature. Once it reaches it, then it won't run constantly. So, you know, you will find that actually it's not on for 8 hours a day. So you can't compare that. Whereas if you put an electric heater on and you leave it on, that is genuinely on for all of that time. And then we come to the hot water bottles, which I said I wanted to get to. And I'll tell you why. How long do you think it takes a full kettle to boil?
2.5 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes. What's your guess? Lee, how long do you reckon it takes to forecast the board? Or are you cheating here because you know the answer?
Sorry, can I just point out I know the answer for the office kettle because Simon performed this test reading the story the other day, and there was much debate in the office whether it was a fair test because the kettle in the office obviously gets used between about 50 and 100 times per day. So I argued that it had seen a lot of action in recent years, so I didn't know if it was a fair assessment. But I'm going to say, I reckon, depending on how good your kettle is, I don't think mine takes more than 2 minutes to boil, a full amount.
Well, I mean, the reason why I did this is I was fact-checking. You see, we take things very seriously.
Yeah,
this,
absolutely.
So seriously that yesterday I went into the office kitchen, filled up the kettle, and then stood there with my phone timing how long it took to boil. And one of our colleagues from another department walked in and saw me standing there. I was like, oh, I'm just timing the kettle. I'm fact-checking an article. She was like...
You keep talking, Simon. I'm going to check it on mine. Keep talking. Yeah.
So it took 3.5 minutes. Now, in my head, a kettle only took 1 minute to boil. So I was quite surprised it took that long. But apparently, with an average 3 kilowatt kettle, you can boil roughly 1 cup of water in a minute. And that costs you 1.4p. So if you fill the kettle, most kettles are about 1.7 litres, that would cost you between 4.1 and 5.2p based on it taking 3 to 4 minutes to boil. So that means a litre of water would cost you about 2.4 to 3p to boil. A hot water bottle typically holds 2 litres of water, but you don't fill it all the way with boiling water because then it'll be too hot, right? You only fill it about two thirds. Mm-hmm. And at a per litre cost of 2.7p, using 1.3 litres in a hot water bottle would cost about 4.7p. And then that hot water bottle will probably stay warm for a number of hours. So it can be a very cost-effective way of warming yourself up slightly.
This led to quite an in-depth conversation in the office about boiling water and about cooking pasta and rice. Because I said that a couple of months ago, I'd read a story in National Geographic, and it was like a university study about how much energy collectively the world wastes by not boiling rice and pasta correctly. Now, how many of you listened to this and just literally blindly put water in a pan, then put it on the hob, then turn on the hob, and then don't measure anything out and just throw in rice, pasta? I reckon there's quite a lot of people that do that. I do that. There is actually science.
You don't boil it first.
No, but this is the conversation.
I always boil it first.
I'm too impatient.
Always boil it first.
I don't think there's any difference. I think I put it on the hob, and depending on how much you're using. But this is
my understanding is the proper Italian way to cook pasta is you shouldn't boil the water first. You are meant to do it from cold and heat it up.
Right.
I reckon I'm 2% Italian because I prefer there's something different about putting the cold water on and boiling it on the hob. Now, this is a big conversation that we have in this house all the time. Because my wife likes to boil a kettle and I'm like, I don't think it makes much difference. But there's an actual full university study about the best way in which to cook pasta and rice. And it was deeply fascinating. And that is the kind of thing that goes on in the This Is Money. It's real highbrow.
But what that also illustrates, and what me timing that kettle yesterday illustrates, and also my thought that the whole kettle would boil in 1 minute, which it clearly doesn't, is, you know, that old nugget about the whole don't fill the kettle up if you don't need to fill the kettle up because you're wasting energy. I've always filed that under life's too short to worry about that kind of stuff, along with, you know, loyalty cards, cash back and all that nonsense, right? Okay, but actually,
says the man with the
if it only takes 1 minute to boil a cup of water in a kettle and you only need 1 cup of tea and that costs you 1.4p versus it taking 3.5 minutes to boil a full kettle and that will cost you about 4.5p, then every time you do that with the full kettle, you're wasting 3p. But you're not just wasting 3p. That 3p does equate, as Lee said, to energy. So you're wasting energy. So if everybody does that and thinks, oh, I can't be bothered, and fills the kettle up, then, you know, as a nation, we are wasting huge amounts of money and huge amounts of energy. So I've changed my mind. From now on, I am not filling up kettles full when I only need 1 cup of water.
Right. Yeah, you shouldn't do. But it still hasn't boiled, you know. So this scientific experiment, how long did you say your one at This Is Money
3.5 minutes. What are you on?
3 minutes 25. It's getting there. It's reaching...
Boil soon.
It's still going, though.
This is massively putting a dent in Lee's argument that R. Kessel only took 3.5 minutes in the office. You know, the alternative to it being overused is like a
3.43.
It is just highly limbered up and so quite efficient.
Well, exactly. 3:43. Bear in mind, I don't like tea. Don't really boil the kettle. So
this should be the new This Is Money tagline. Please tune in to listen to 3:43 of George.
Yeah, you know that. You know that thing about
this is the best content.
It's like watching paint dry. It's like listening to people boil a kettle on a podcast.
They love it.
You just wasted 4.5p there.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And I've done it for the bad of the planet as well. So,
yeah, but you've done it for the bad of the planet, but you've done it for the purpose of educating This Is Money podcast listeners, who anybody listening to this will now think twice before needlessly boiling a full kettle.
Or before listening to this podcast. Lee, one more article we have on this subject, which got me a little bit confused, actually.
Long-term listeners are going to be going, I used to prefer the Christmas taste test to the Christmas kettle.
Definitely, I'm not saying that.
It's a cost of living crisis. Households, right, that can heat their... Look, stop. You're distracting me. Focus. You have another article, Lee, on your website about how households that heat their homes with log burners are buying less fuel and making it stretch further. Okay, but there's a lot of supposition in this article. So just explain to me what's going on. I was also really surprised to see that traditional household coal was banned in May. Again, I haven't used a coal burning fire. Well, I've never used one, but, you know, when I was a kid, back in 19. What's this story about, Lee?
Yeah, it was just an interview with the boss of Home Fire, who are one of the biggest sort of suppliers of this kind of fuel for it's more than 1 million homes that are kind of using these log burners. And some of these places are rural, off-grid type places that aren't connected to central heating, for example. So have to do this. And what he's saying is it's been a massive trend shift this year. People not stocking up and buying it in quantity, but more like little and often as a way of budgeting. So obviously, it's a big shift to what they're used to seeing. People, it's one of those things, if you are in a rural place, you might buy this stuff in bulk, keep it in a kind of dry house or something like that, or in your garage or wherever. But it seems that people are kind of, to budget better, are buying it sort of little and often. And that's really the kind of nub of the story. But the reason why we did the story and published it is that anything to do with log burners, people would just kind of love reading it. They just log burners, and they love to tell us about their log burners. It keeps it all inclusive, doesn't it, George? You know, I've talked about vast majority of people have gas boilers, but we're not forgetting about the people that are off grid and don't have that as an option. And that's all the story is, really. Just the kind of this is the shift. Now, I don't have a log burner, but I do have a little bit of a confession of what I like to do at this time of year, and I did it the other day. Or two things, actually. I have one of those solo stoves. I absolutely love it.
A what? Right.
A solo stove is an outdoor kind of smokeless fire pit, right? So you start a fire and it's really nice this time of year. So that's my confession one. I quite like putting it on. I do it from time to time. I like doing it in winter and the summer. But the other thing I do quite like doing, which, again, people listening to this might go, yeah, I do that. Or they might go, what on earth? My most watched program on Netflix at this time of year is The Log Burner. It's just literally a video of logs burning in a fire, and it makes the room feel kind of like warm and toasty, and it crackles. And
on Netflix, you say?
Yep. You can just put on the log fire video, and you can feel like you're in a nice cabin somewhere snowy with a nice glass of wine.
Let me explore that, Lee. I was wondering if your next feature is going to be the amount of energy it takes to have one of those on Netflix, as it does, and with the subscription. All right, Lee, I believe you. I believe you. You're holding up your screen.
It's my number one most watched thing at the moment. Fireplace
4K. Okay, right.
Just the head of the Grinch.
That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. The state pension triple lock, the expensive albatross around the neck of any government looking to manage a budget. Well, the IFS may have come up with a solution about what to do with it. A 4-point guarantee. Simon, firstly, the issue with the triple lock, who's the IFS? What is their suggestion?
The issue with the triple lock is that it is expensive. It promises to give the state pension a rise of either a minimum of 2.5%, inflation, or wages. And that has led to the state pension rising substantially in comparison to the level that it was at previously, and it has become a much better benefit for people. On the flip side, it costs a lot of money, and there has been a question of whether we can afford to be giving this money to pensioners at a time when we're cutting back on many other things and working people are struggling, cost of living crisis, taxes going up, etc. One of the criticisms of the triple lock is that, you know, the outcome hasn't been too bad in terms of improving our pension, but the aim of it is a bit woolly. It's like, why 2.5% all wages or inflation? What are we actually trying to do here other than make the state pension go up? And it was brought in because of all those years of minimal rises. The IFS is the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a leading think tank and is non-partisan. So it's not affiliated to the Tories or the Labour Party or the Lib Dems. And it tends to do a really good job of looking at problems like this and coming up with ideas of how to solve them. So it has come up with what is effectively a quadruple lock, but it's not a quadruple lock as in the way that we might think about the triple lock. It's instead a four-point plan. And these 4 points are a four-point pension guarantee. One, increases in the state pension would in the long run, keep pace with average earnings growth, including bonuses as at present, which ensures that pensioners benefit when living standards rise. Two, both before and after the target level is reached, the state pension would continue to increase at least in line with inflation each year. Three, the state pension would not be means tested. Four, the state pension age would only rise as longevity at older age increases, but never by the full amount of that increase. The government would write to people around their 50th birthday stating what their state pension age is expected to be, and their state pension age would be fully guaranteed 10 years before they reach it. So this is a way to try and make the state pension better. It's not as catchy as the triple lock, but it's definitely a lot more comprehensive.
Will it work? Will it be adopted?
I don't know. I mean, look, at the end of the day, the triple lock is very, very popular amongst a certain chunk of people, largely the people who are getting the state pension and are seeing it go up, and they feel that they are owed that. You know, they paid in all my life, worked all my life, all that kind of stuff. The UK state pension isn't amazing. The UK state pension isn't amazing when you compare it to other countries, but you're not comparing apples with apples. You're comparing central heating with electric heaters, because many countries also roll in their workplace pension schemes into their state entitlements in a way that we don't, for example. So France does that, whereas we tend to have separate workplace pensions. And once you factor in workplace pensions, like with many things, Britain just ends up middle of the road. We're kind of in the middle of the pack. We've got a poll, though. So what should we do? Keep the state triple lock or move to a new guarantee linked to wages? So I'm going to go with a different plan. Tell us in the comments, because I have a different plan. And there's only 3% voting my way. 78% are saying stick with the triple lock. And 19% are saying new four-point guarantee. My plan, which I talked about on here before, is to say, right, what do we want? We want pensioners to hopefully get a little bit better off every year, so that we want them to beat inflation. So I think we should have 3%, which is the inflation target, plus 1%, or inflation plus 1%, whichever is higher. So if inflation is, you know, 5%, pensioners get 6%. And that means that in real terms, they get a little bit richer each year. And it will be expensive, but it's got a purpose. And, you know, it probably is better if, as we were talking about earlier, in terms of the old normal, if people do get a little bit richer genuinely each year rather than just treading water.
Quite. Lee, before we move on to the next item, I have to say I have on The Fireplace now on Netflix. It is a lovely, warm, fiery glow behind your faces. I'm just wondering if psychologically just having it in the background makes me feel warmer. So, you know, maybe there's an energy heating tip, you know? Anyway, Happy New Year. the fraudsters. We're being warned to watch out in 2024 after ticket scams soared by over 500% last year, according to Lloyds. Now, it's not just tickets, though. Thousands of us buying cars, pets and so much more were tricked into handing our hard-earned cash over to criminals this year. And shockingly, social media was the main hunting ground for scammers. Not shockingly, but it's the percentage. Nearly 80% of purchase scams started on these platforms. Lee, the scam man, Boyce. Ugh, God, I thought we had some sort of a charter or something that was going to help this. I mean, is the social media issue ever going to be fixed with this scamming-ness?
It needs to be, doesn't it? Because when you're talking about 4 in 5 purchase scams coming from social media sites that, in my opinion, tend to sort of wash their hands of it because they don't have payment platforms or any kind of, you know, need to. We talked about this on the podcast recently about this new charter and whether it was going to help or not. But in the meantime, Lloyds has come out with this sort of scams to watch next year. You know, scams have increased popularity this year and heading into next year, and they're kind of key terms of things. And it's almost like a really bad episode of Top of the Pops 2. You've got Taylor Swift and the Uggs and Rottweiler. They're not actually band names. I mean, Taylor Swift is. But essentially, there are 5 categories, right? So the first one that Lloyds are saying is really grown this year is ticket scams. And that's the kind of fear of missing out on concerts and sporting events. And the average loss of this is between sort of 100 and 150 quid. And it's gone up massively this year, especially concerts. It's something up like 500%, where people basically, almost too good to be true, here's some tickets, you've missed out, and, you know, you can get them here. Mm. Now, the number one they're talking about here is Taylor Swift and her tour next year, which has been immensely popular. It's one of the best-selling tours of all time. And lots of people have missed out on tickets. And then you act irrationally because, you know, you might be a Swifty, then you're acting swiftly to try and get the tickets and not really engaging in what you're doing and thinking, oh, I've got tickets here. And, you know, you can see how it happens. And then the other two things that they're pointing out for next year is the Euros, obviously going to be very popular. People wanted to go to that. The Olympics in Paris as well. They're saying that tread carefully if you're after tickets for any of those. The next thing it lists is pet scams. That was up 24% this year. Yorkshire Terriers, Rottweilers and Pomeranians are the most likely you are to get scammed on. Again, it's just one of those things where you might get hoodwinked by a scammer saying, got this dog, dog's going to go quick, really good breed. You see all the cute photos, you fall in love with it, and then you pay a deposit and you haven't actually seen the dog and the dog doesn't exist and then you're out of money. You can see again how that happens. So the advice there is don't hand over any money until you've sort of seen the pet, got the pet, know the pet exists. And it's the same a little bit with vehicle scams. I know we've spoken about this. This has been a big riser this year, up 74% this year. And these scams tend to be a bit more high value because of it being a car. Lots of people put down a deposit. We've seen used cars soar in value in the last couple of years, although it's starting to soften a little bit recently. But lots of people, if you're panicked, you know, you've had a car that's written off or you're in desperate need to get a new set of wheels, you know, there's so many car adverts now going up on things like Facebook Marketplace, and people just blindly hand over the cash for a deposit because they fear of missing out on what seems to be a really good deal. So again, take your time, think about it. The next category they talk about is designer goods. And the designer goods that they're talking about here are Nike, Uggs, Louis Vuitton and Chanel. Now, the reason why people click through on these things and might fall victim to scam is that very rarely are these items on discount. These brands are kind of brands that don't discount that often. So if you see a 25% off or 50% off Louis Vuitton or Ugg, you might go, oh, that's good. And again, you can just, it's that kind of blind scrolling through sort of social media and just, it just pops up all of a sudden. You're like, oh, that looks good. Yeah. And you need to click through, and before you know it, you know, you're in a kind of like really chill, relaxed mode, watching your 4K fireplace in the background, and you're just scrolling. And then you're like, oh, yeah, a nice pair of Uggs will go well with this and keep my feet toasty indoors. And then before you know it, you fall victim to scam. And the last one, and I think this one is very applicable for the new year. Lots of us have got used to January sales when it comes to holidays, and get to January after Christmas, holidays are on a lot of people's minds, just sick of the weather, sick of the doom and gloom, sick of their families. And they're thinking, you know what, let's get a holiday booked. And a lot of the big players do January sales, but there's a lot of hoodwinking that goes on social media, kind of, you know, £200 for this five-star package, like five nights away here. And you think, oh, that sounds like a good deal. Nice sandy beach. You get absolutely kind of swept up by it all. And you might do things, you might act in a way that you're not used to doing. Again, a lot of it just plays on that fear of missing out. It might be a kind of like, this deal's only existing for 3 hours, 6 hours, flash sale. Flash sale is one of those terms, I think, that gets people. And the reason why we're mentioning this on the podcast and the reason why Lloyds has kind of put this out there is just that if you are those five categories in the coming months, just tread with absolute caution, especially if you spot this stuff on social media. And I mean it, like, spread the message far and wide. You know, you want tickets to Taylor Swift. Very hard to get tickets to Taylor Swift. The supply and demand, you know, it's very, very difficult. You're going to have children badgering you, pestering you for those tickets, and you're going to feel under pressure to get them, perhaps ahead of Christmas, perhaps in the new year. But if it looks too good to be true and it's originating on social media, have a really long, hard think about it.
That's a slight twist to an old saying that you used to use a lot, Lee. I said, you know, if we could put it up and frame it, if it sounds too good to be true, and you saw it on social media. Finally, Lee, we want you. Not you. You want the listener.
Yeah,
Tommy, work with me. Work with me.
I've gone full Lord Kitchener here. We want you. Yeah. So it was just our newsletter this week, and if you're not getting our newsletter, you really should. This is money.co.uk/newsletter, which has all of our great stories from the week in one nice Thursday morning package to brighten up the end of your week. Thursday newsletter, Friday podcast. What else? What else could you possibly? Right. Life. Now, what I mean by we want you is that the lifeblood of This Is Money is our readers and our listeners and people getting in touch when things go wrong. Now, we don't really want to have to step in when things go wrong. We'd rather that financial firms, government organizations, you know, we've said this before, we'd rather they just do the right thing and solve problems big and small before it lands on our map, basically. And we have a great team of personal finance journalists. I won't go through and name them all, but we are always poised over the editor's inbox looking for gems, looking for things that are coming in. editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you do have a problem. And in the last couple of months, I think that we've really been on top of our game and at the forefront of a lots of stuff. So I'm just going to really quickly rattle off some of the things that I've been really proud of in the last couple of months. I think one of the big stories that we've been really on top of has been the Royal Mail and just how the service at Royal Mail seems to have gone to the dogs. We are being told by posties up and down the country and from people that use Royal Mail, including small businesses, that it feels like the service really has hit the skids in the last couple of months. And, you know, we're being told that they're prioritising parcels over letters, something the Royal Mail completely denies, but we keep on hearing time and time again. We've had lots of small organisations and charities and things being debanked by Barclays, having their accounts sort of shut and frozen without any kind of, you know, well, they're getting noticed, but they're struggling to get the problem solved. That's where Helen Crane and Helen Corain, yeah, that's two different heads, almost the same name, have been really battling on. Another bank that's been in our crosshairs in recent months is NatWest. They offered a really good ISA over the summer. Great. But we've had lots of people getting in touch about bodged ISA transfers and it taking months for the money to land into the new account. We've had £2 million worth of bodged ISAs that we've reported on. And we've had a dossier of OVO complaints, 450 complaints we've sent over to both OVO and to Ofgem from Helen Crane's Great Crane on the Case column. And that's the thing, we scratch the surface, right, Georgia, one of these things. We report on one of your OVO problems, you know, this bill's inaccurate, I can't get them to sort it, write a story about it. Then all of a sudden we've got 20. And we're like, okay, well, we should do a follow-up on that. Then all of a sudden, we've got 200. And then all of a sudden, it's like we've blown the whole thing wide open. You know, we scratched the surface and it's either, it was just a one-off problem or there's loads of people that get in touch. And it's the same for Tanya as well in the pension stuff. So she's been really on the top-ups fiasco, people paying to top up the state pension and it actually not really being added on or it's taking years. You know, she keeps on fighting that corner and it goes on and on and on. And, you know, we just want you to keep getting in touch and telling us. And, you know, that includes listeners to the podcast.
I'd also like to know if anybody has listened to the podcast or read an article, a bit like when you just gave advice there about scams or anything, and read one of these OVOs or the debanked Barclays or Royal Mail, and it's saved them some money, or, you know, I'm sure you get loads of that anyway, but I'd be really curious anyway to hear from those listeners as well, because you hear a lot of complaints, but actually it's not about you guys, obviously, about, you know, the...
complaints about kettles being boiled.
Quite. Then we might have a couple after this one. But, you know, it might be nice to hear the sort of the kind of follow-ups to the ones you don't hear, you know, people reading your stories and learning stuff. Simon?
100% agree. It's not just watching fires on TV and boiling kettles. You know, we actually try to do some genuine, you know, journalistic work. And the team do an amazing job of winning money back for people, educating people about problems. And, you know, if one person reads it and goes, phew, that could have happened to me, then that's a result.
And quickly before we move on, I just wanted to shout out to a couple of our listeners who got in touch on the request a couple of weeks ago about Spotify Wrapped. So Spotify Wrapped is when it kind of gives you your kind of top five musicians, artists of the year, but also podcasts these days. So I'm going to quickly just tell you of five that got in touch with us, because I think they're really nice. So we've got Connor. He said, great show as always, and look forward to hearing the voices of sanity every Friday. Keep up the good work. As you can see, you rank first in my podcast listening. And by coincidence, I will be looking to retire in my early 60s to spend half my time in the Orkneys. So Lee's property update was most welcome. So there we go. When I said, if there's anyone listening on the Orkneys after we talked about them, doesn't technically live there yet, but maybe soon. Paul, number one on the podcast list and number one on the music list. He actually sent his music list over as well. Run the Jewels. He says, my music tastes are very different from my podcast tastes. I mainly listen to punk and hip hop at the moment. Now, punk and hip hop, I would argue, are two categories of music that Simon and I are quite fond of, especially the hip hop. And then we've got Simon's written in, not Simon Lambert, a different Simon. I just listened to the last podcast episode and can proudly say that the This Is Money podcast featured in my Spotify Wrap this year. So thanks for that. Then we've got Vilius. And I love this one. This is absolutely great. He said, as you can see, This Is Money has been my favourite. Even though I live in Lithuania, the topics you guys discuss are applicable outside of the UK too. So thanks for that. Special thanks for Georgie and Simon. Combining all of you into one podcast makes my Saturday morning something to wait for. Have a great Christmas. And Simon, don't get any more loyalty cards. And he's in the top 5% fan. And then my favourite, my overall favourite. This is a shout out to
all your favourites, Lee. Adam.
It happens that I'm in the top 3% of your listeners. So in the Spotify Wrap, if you're right at the top of listeners, it shows you which percent you're in. He said, the most odd thing with my Wrapped against the pod is the Bluey theme tune, which is constantly being played for my 10-month-old Lucas. So his number one is the This Is Money podcast. And then just to balance it, the cartoon Bluey, which is a big hit in this household, the Adventures of an Australian Dog Family is the number one song. I love that. Now, if you can beat top 3% of listeners, are you in the top 2.5% of listeners? That's what we want to know. Keep getting your Spotify Wraps over. We love reading them.
We do indeed. That is it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions, team, anything you'd like them to look into, Lee has appealed to you directly. But Simon, just remind us.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and stick podcast in the subject line, and then whatever else you're emailing about, even if it's how long it takes your kettle to boil. You can tweet us at This Is Money, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join the debate and read the comments. And just to say, the most appropriate medium for telling us about how long it takes your kettle to boil is either to tweet us or to leave a comment in the comments. Please don't deluge us with emails about how long it takes your kettle to boil.
Will it be 3:43? Why I felt the need to write that down? Like, I'm going to use it for later.
Now I'll report back.
Right. Time it. Okay.
I'm sure it's not 3:43. I'm going to go.
It's a long time.
Now.
It's an unused, unloved kettle. Bye, Lee.
He's going to be so disappointed when he discovers his kettle won't boil in 2 minutes.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.